ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is Good Humans Podcast with me, Cooper Chapman, chatting to the world's best about the inspiring stories that got them to where they are today.
What's going on, you good humans? Welcome to a very special episode of Good Humans Podcast. This is episode number 133 with Chris Lake. Chris is an incredible music producer, one of the best DJs in the world, and someone who I'm very lucky to get to call mate, so it was epic to have this chat. If it's your first time tuning in today, do me a huge favor, hit that like or subscribe button, give us 5 stars if you enjoy the episode, but most importantly, if you get some value out of this episode, you learn something about Chris's story, and you think it can, yeah, have an impact on others in your community, share the episode with them. It takes a few seconds, and yeah, it means so much to us. Chuck it on your Instagram story and tag us both. I'm sure Chris and myself will be very stoked about that. A big thank you to our sponsors, Drink a Rapper. These guys have been supporting this podcast for the last 18 months, and I use their product every single day. It's a brain drink. So if you're someone who's got a brain and want to take better care of it, you should go check out Drink a Rapper. You can head over to their website, drinkarapper.com, use the code GOODHUMAN for 25% off all of their products, but you can also learn about the science that has gone into their product. It's a beautiful black currant flavored juice with all natural ingredients and all different tests and stuff done to, yeah, make it really help your brain, both for short-term performance and for long-term brain health. So go check that out. Also, very exciting times with the Good Human Factory. As of 6 p.m. tonight, when this episode comes out, we've just dropped a brand new range of merch. I've spent a lot of time putting this one together. There's 9 new shirts for men, 9 new shirts for women. There's a couple really cool tote bags and bucket hats as well. I love getting to do this range. There's really cool new designs and colors. The sizes have kind of expanded down to extra small up to double extra large in both men and women, actually just down to small in men. But yeah, I love these designs and they're just so comfortable. I've got a new merch person who's been making the eco-friendly bags for us as well, which is amazing. I actually gave Chris some of the merch and he sent me a message yesterday before putting this podcast out saying, mate, this merch is comfy AF. Thanks for it. So there's a little firsthand that Chris enjoys the merch too. But yeah, today's episode is just incredible. about the merch. If you want to get some merch, use the code podcast over on thegoodhumanfactory.com and you get a big 25% off. And yeah, it's a good way to support my mental health workshops, keep this podcast growing, and yeah, spread some positive vibes in your community. So on to today's episode, Chris Lake. Chris has been someone who I've known for a couple of years. I've known his music for a very long time and admired it from afar. But ever since my sister has become really close friends with Chris and his wife, Gita, and obviously also Fisher, my brother-in-law, it's just been so cool getting to know Chris a bit more personally and learn his story. And he's over in Australia to do some festivals called Spilt Milk. And he was staying very close by to where I live. And I was like, mate, would you like to have a chat on the podcast? And he was like, yeah, of course. So I love that I got to get this access to Chris. He gave me such a vulnerable chat all the way back, took me through his story. And yeah, it really fascinated me. Some big ups and downs throughout the journey and just, yeah, an amazing work ethic, which has got him to where he is today. So let's jump into today's episode. Welcome to Good Humans Podcast, Chris Lake.
How you going, mate?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm happy to be here. It's nice to be on the Gold Coast. Nice to see you. Nice to see all the crew out here.
It's been fun, eh? It's been a fun couple of days. You've got a few weeks here in Oz, so.
Yeah, it's nice. It's good to be here. You know, it's like it just developed a lot of friends out here. You know, lots of colleagues, obviously, you know, have such a big social circle now with being friends with Fish and, you know, with your family. Sister. All your family, all Fish's family and, the honorary family as well. You know, it runs pretty deep. It's nice to see everyone.
I know, it's pretty funny here on the Gold Coast as well. Like Chloe and Fish have like such a big network that also have the means to kind of get to travel and hang out a bit. So you kind of get like different Gold Coast people all around the world watching you guys from time to time.
Yeah, I was going to say half the people that were there at the show on was it Sunday? Yeah. Was it Sunday?
Yeah.
Yeah, Sunday. Yeah, I've seen them like six times in the last, you know, year in different conferences.
And it's so funny how like crossed over the world. He's like Eric, who's your tour manager now, has been like a close friend of mine for like over 10 years from the surf industry. So it's like everything kind
of
that's part of the
connection. You know, there's this sort of mostly through Fish and Brett, and they're kind of like, I say Brett's connection to the surfing industry. He doesn't really have a direct connection with the surf industry apart from representing, you know, managing Fish, and but he has a love for the industry, and then you know, all the people that he's met along the way, Eric being one of them. And you know, that's how it all came up, when, you know, I'm like, I need someone to go on the road, and you know, Brett's like, yeah, I think I've got, you know, I've got an idea of someone that can give it a go. Let's try Eric. You know, I think he's got the right demeanor for it. Yeah, I think he's been on the road with me for almost 6 years now.
Has Eric been with you for 6 years?
Definitely five. Wow. Definitely five, yeah.
And he seems to be got his finger in everything, but it's amazing. But today's about you. So what I always open my podcast with is the same question for everyone. And you probably know from all the merch I always wear that I'm big on gratitude. So what are you grateful for in your life right now?
Definitely grateful for I didn't actually know that was a question you were going to ask, but I'm grateful for being able to do what I love to do, something that, you know, I feel passionate about. Having great family and friends and health, you know, keep it simple. I'm you know, happy to, I'm just happy to be doing what I love and be surrounded by people I love.
Which is a privilege sometimes. So many people are doing work that they don't love. And I mean, obviously 100%. Doing what you do is something quite spectacular, being one of the top DJs in the world and getting to tour all around the world, experience these people, cultures, but most importantly, bring joy to people and bring a good time to people. And it was really funny when I got home from Europe, because obviously the work I do in mental health and stuff, I have like a lot of people who kind of appreciate what I do. And somebody replied to one of my things after being on stage watching Fish with 50,000 people, replied like, wouldn't it be great if Fisher used what he does to actually like help people like you do with mental health? And I was like, I wrote back to him, and I like, normally I won't bite on things like that. And I was like, hey, he's doing it on a million times scale of what I'm doing. Everyone who goes to watch music, like your shows, Fisher's shows, leave having the best time ever. Like, that's great for their mental health.
There's so many different ways to bring happiness and or deliver a message. You know, there's more direct ways, there's more educational ways, and then there's just, you know, kind of like ways via distraction. I think Fish does that, you know, kind of like it's there's a magic to, well, I do that, you know, with shows and performance. It's like takes people somewhere else, puts them in a different space, a different environment, gives them a very different feeling. And it's like the idea about it is you know, there's a lot of it's about, well, for what we do with dancing and everything, you know, we're trying to make people dance, trying to, as long as we're playing. I can only speak for myself or Fish. You know, I know that all we care about is just making people dance for a very long time. As long as we're playing, make them have the best time ever, and, you know, forget whatever else is going on in their life. And it feels, you know, it's nice to be able to achieve that and see people have those experiences. So, and I think it helps people. I think these situations leave quite an impression on people. Some of these nights these are the moments that people don't forget in their lifetime.
Well, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a really nice thing to do. So that's, and you know, for me, the more events I do, the further I get in my life doing this kind of work and being involved in events, the more I appreciate how impactful these events can be and how long people remember them.
That's the thing. Like, you hear so many people go like, I'll openly say it, like that night in Ibiza, you weren't there, but when Fish opened Ibiza this year, I was like, by far the best night of my life when it comes to like partying and having a good time. And at a music festival, I love it, because like, even though there's people intoxicated and off their head and stuff, everyone's just having a good time. Even when I was in the crowd watching you the other night with like my mate Corey, just like looking around, just everyone's bouncing up and down, having a good time. And like, music's medicine. I think it's
I think so.
Yeah, I think so for sure. Today we're gonna get to know your story a bit though. I've known you for a while. Actually, it's funny. and you'll probably remember this too. The first time we met, I was like, oh, I wonder if Chris even knows. Like, I knew you probably knew who I was because of my sister, but it took us a while to actually meet. Like, you met Sophia and my other sisters and my mom and everyone else, but not me.
Yeah, you were the last one.
Because you meant to come to the wedding and you didn't end up coming because...
Well, I was there. I was there for like a day and a half. And then we had a family stuff, so I had to go straight home.
That's right, and I missed the bus because I had something else on. So we like
I, there was loads of people I didn't get to meet. Obviously I never got to meet Chumpy. I never got to. There was a lot of friends. I've met most people now, but there's some kind of like very important people, and you know, your guys' lives I didn't actually even get to meet at all.
Oh, yeah, my grandma as well.
Yeah, of course, exactly. So it's pretty crazy little time, but yeah, we eventually met. And,
I knew
who you were.
But ever since then, I feel like you've been such a legend. It's been nice getting to become friends just in the small interactions out at the clubs and at the kind of inner circle that we get to hang in sometimes. But to be honest, I don't know much about your story at all, and that's what today's going to be about. So
it's not that interesting.
It's pretty interesting. It's definitely interesting. But let's rewind back to the start. Uh-huh. Where were you born? Where'd you grow up? What was life like? Let's tall up into a teenager, family dynamics that I need to know to maybe understand who you are today.
Yeah. Born in Norwich in England. So Norwich is like two and a half hours northeast of London. Grew up there until I was about 13. Got one sister. My father worked, he worked in Northern Ireland for nearly 8 years of that kind of that 12-year period. So most of my early childhood was kind of spent with my, brought up by my mother and my grandmother. And until 12 or 13? And then we ended up moving to Northern Ireland to be with my father. We lived there for a year and then something went wrong with his work. Ended up moving to Scotland. That's where I lived for probably another 10 years or something like that. That's where I really got into music when I was in Scotland. Yeah. So if I roll back a couple of years before that, when I the last few years in England, both my grandfathers were into music. They both played what looks like the church organ. So in where I was from, maybe you have them here, they'd be like these sort of more modern looking church organs. Mm-hmm. So the two-tier keyboards and the foot pedals. Uh-huh. And so they both knew how to play them. One of my grandfather on my mother's side played the saxophone in the 60s in some bands. He actually played, the band that he was in, I forgot the name of the band, John Wayne and the Pretenders or something like that. Something like that. He actually performed in Hamburg alongside the Beatles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so before, with the original members. There was a changeover after a few years. But yeah, so he got to perform alongside them, but then transitioned into playing the organ. Anyway, so when I was growing up, I'd go over to my grandfather's place and both of them, I'd sit at the organ and learn how to, start playing some notes. And then that grandfather was just explaining about he was like, I think you got some flair for this, maybe you should go and get some lessons. So I was doing keyboard lessons for like a year, and I really enjoyed the play and the performing, but I hated the theory. I just hated the theory, and the way it worked with these schools is if you couldn't like progress. Unless you can like matched up with your theory. So I ended up just sort of stagnating on my learnings with playing the keyboard, and then I moved to Northern Ireland, stopped playing. So when we ended up going to Scotland, I was at that age in my school where I had to choose my subjects for what to do in high school, and one of the subjects I chose was music, and that's when I met a friend who called Andy, who was making music on keyboards and synthesizers. And I thought this was the coolest thing ever. And that's when I started looking into how I could start doing that myself. So that's essentially how I got into music production. Just like starting to figure out how can I learn how to make music. Mm-hmm.
So this is through your high school days?
This is through high school. I was about 14 or 15.
Okay, so you started learning. What did, obviously becoming a musician is a pretty tough job to become successful in, I guess you'd call it, to turn it into making a living. Mm-hmm. What else did you think when you were at school the future might have looked like?
Well, I was definitely not thinking too much about the future. Not too much, but... No, there was like, it was more, I had an interest. I wanted to... learn how to become competent, mm-hmm. like figure out how to make beats
and
how to operate the equipment. This stuff was, you know, music making's kind of complicated in a way. Well, definitely
back then,
you know, there was a lot more, you know, I was explaining to you yesterday, it was more based around hardware. You know, it was expensive to buy. Once you bought one piece of equipment, then you needed another piece of equipment. You had to figure out a way to link them up, and
it's hard.
You buy one thing and then you cause more problems. You have to buy more things, and it's just like it's a money pit. It's so expensive. And, you know, I was just trying to.
And that was for more so electronic music though. That
was what you were drawn to. Yeah. Like, so at the same time, I was developing a love of, dance music.
Yeah.
And really what I first started doing was I was trying to recreate popular dance tracks that you know, I was listening to at the time, or were on the radio. Or
who were some of your inspirations back then?
I mean, I'm thinking like actually some of these songs are getting really big right now again. I was remaking ATB Till I Come and Robert Miles' Children, tracks like this. Alice DJ, Better Off Alone. These are like the big songs that were like big at the time. Mm-hmm. I was remaking them, learning how to like try and make them feel the same way.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't really making anything particularly original. It was just sort of, it was like imitation.
Learning the craft by imitating, and then you can put your own flair on it a bit later, kind of thing.
But over time, I guess I learned how to have my own ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just slowly that kind of developed.
When you say recreating, was it like trying to use your own instruments to then recreate the song? So it's probably a really good way to learn how to use the equipment you had to its potential by trying to recreate something without maybe having to have the creative element of coming up with your own stuff.
Yeah. So it was just like, it was almost like, okay, well, this is something that works that I enjoy listening to. Mm-hmm. So how did they make it? Reverse engineer it. Understand what... you know, all the components of it, how it all comes together, mm-hmm. and how it makes you feel, and you know, and it's actually really hard. It's quite easy to make this stuff sound terrible, and most of it did sound terrible, but it just over time, you know, just it's like repetitions. It's with same with surfing, same with speaking, same with walking, running, anything. It's just, you know, the practice, more you do it, the better you get. And over time I got better. I started having my own ideas, started, you know, realizing.
Still towards the end of high school?
Maybe.
Last couple of years.
Yeah.
Was there another job in between?
So I did lots of jobs. So my father was working. The reason he was working away from home was he worked in the fishing industry. So he was a manager. He still is a manager of fish processing factories. So. Uh-huh. The good thing about that was there was always seasonal work, and most of the seasons lined up with my school holidays. So ever since being a teenager, I actually never took holidays.
You can make money to buy your music equipment.
That's exactly what
good
I did.
Good on
you. Yeah. So it was crap work. I mean, just really.
Fish processing plant sounds fun.
It stunk. I absolutely stunk, but you know what? I'm proud. I'm actually, you know, I look back on it now, and I'm quite proud of having taken that approach. Maybe it probably wasn't the best idea to just like use all of my time to be working to make money to be able to do music. But regardless, that dedication kind of got me started, and I know. I was able to build on it. So
it's a big lesson that for any young kids nowadays, you just feel like there's so much expectation now. It's so much access to opportunity almost, it seems like now. But I think hearing that story is a good one for a young kid out there. It's like, oh, I can't afford it. It's like, go work your school holidays, save up for that new MacBook so you can use that computer so you can make the music.
Yeah, like, I think, I definitely think, I look back on it now and I think it was, you know, had a big impact on me. It made me like,
was it intrinsic or was it from your parents? Was there like push from your parents to do it, or it was all just you going, "Nah, I want this."
I was reflecting on this the other day. I was with them a couple of weeks ago, and I said thank you to them for how much encouragement they've given me ever since I got into music. They've always been nothing but positive, and never kind of like sort of. They never actually said to me, don't you think you should be doing something else? Even when they probably should have said to me, don't you think you should be doing something else? They've been absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I obviously showed an interest in wanting to make money because I knew, you know, I remember the first keyboard I bought was £800. So that's a lot of money. It's a lot of money for I wasn't. It took a long time to save that money.
Yeah,
up.
I bet.
But yeah, got it, and then had to keep saving for the next thing. But you know, I was lucky. I was lucky because my father had the ability to give me that seasonal work. You know, so I was lucky. I was definitely fortunate.
And lucky, regard, but you know, still I had to have to go it, and
so,
do the work.
Yeah. Like. So. Yeah, so anyway, that was a big part of my childhood. But, you know, that just developed over time. And an interest turned into a, you know, like a hobby turned into a serious hobby that turned into question mark. Could I make something of this?
So, yeah, we talked about this last night when we were in a chat. What was the sort of first big break? So you finished school, a couple of years of, what were some of the jobs that you were balancing trying to make music and then go DJ at night?
Yeah, so... happened. I did a lot of seasonal work through my father. A lot of that. And then I went to. Well, what else did I do? I'm trying to remember now.
It's been
a while. I did. I started doing music full time for a little while.
Were you making money there? So you started making some tracks that were getting picked up.
I was still living with my parents, so you know, I didn't need to make lots of money, luckily.
Like getting gigs DJing at like nightclubs.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, so there's a little bit of money there, doing regional stuff, and then a few. You know, I started releasing some records. I started making bootlegs, printing them to vinyl, and selling them. So made a bit of money there. All illegal. But you know, that's kind of like what you did back then. And
I'm sure plenty of people have ripped off your music.
Exactly. Karma's a bitch. So, and then what happened? I think, I remember this is, we're now into like kind of 2002. Yeah. 2002, 2003. I'd had a couple of records. There was a few things that were kind of like, doing pretty decent in the underground. If I took under my name. Your camera just died a death.
Keep going.
I'm still trying to remember what I did.
Yeah, give me that 20.
Yeah, so I remembered. So I had a few records that were doing, you know, nicely in the underground. I was kind of, by this point, I was trying to essentially make records. The way that I described it was I was living in the northeast of Scotland. It's quite remote. Part of the world, and my only real connection with the scene and my understanding of the scene was through message boards through the internet on dial-up internet. How old are you?
29. I remember dial-up, it was atrocious.
It was so slow. You know, you couldn't use the phone if I was using the dial-up. I dominated the phone line in our house. It was terrible. Just trying to send songs that I'd made to DJs to try and get them to play. To play stuff. And anyway, I'd had a bit of success. I was making records essentially to try and get Sasha and Digweed to play them. Sasha and Digweed being quite very big DJs at the time. And I had some success with it, but I was slow. I was very, very slow and kind of, I just don't actually think I had the best work ethic with regards to trying to get things finished and, you know, make things happen. I was a bit lazy. And then I was living quite rurally at the time, and out in the countryside. And what would happen was I was getting sent, by this point, I was developing a little bit of a name in the kind of underground scene. And I was getting sent vinyl promos. So records by record labels send it to me to try and get me to play it in my sets. And I'd have to, there'd be like reaction forms. I'd have to write what I thought of the song and then mail it back to people. To the record labels. And there was a postman that was delivering these records to me, and he'd always be asking me questions about, you know, what I was getting sent. And he was just, you know, we got talking, got to know each other, and somehow the conversation turned to the fact that there was jobs going at the post office. And just around about that time, I was kind of like essentially coming to terms with the fact that I'm a bit of a lazy bastard. I'm just not really making anything happen. I think if I want to continue this, I need to get a job. This is getting silly. So I ended up taking a job at the post office, and I had that for nearly 3 years. I was basically a postman.
No
way. Yeah. So, and I ended up being the floater, which is, so I essentially had to do, I had to fill in for anyone's days off, essentially. So I had to do every job. So that could be out on the bike, you know, or just, you know, walking around with a bag in freezing weather in Scotland.
Cold. Oh my God.
Or out in the van, or working in the office. I had to do it all. I'll be honest with you, I loved that job. It was fantastic. And the best thing about it was, it's not the best thing really. I had to get up early, work, do a full day's shift, but I was finished early. Uh-huh. So it allowed me to work on music afterwards at the sacrifice of sleep. But regardless, I was young, so it didn't really matter. And did that for 3 years. And then in the third year, I said to my family and friends at the time, I'm like, I have to make something happen here. If I made a promise to everyone, it's like, if I don't make something significant happen with my career in this next year, I'll search for an education. I want to train to be something.
22, 21?
Something like that. 23 maybe.
23.
And so I set myself some goals. I told myself I've got to make something happen. I gave myself a year to make something significant happen. And if I didn't, then I'd give up and move on to something else. Anyway, that year I just worked like crazy. I really got my focus. I found a flow. I really found a sound. I found like my thing. And in that time I made a track called Changes, and that song blew up. It ended up being my big song at the time. Got into the UK top 40. It just opened up all doors. I've got a central new tune on Radio One twice with that song. Got a big booking agent, got a manager, all of these things.
Yeah,
so the whole career just kind of like opened up. And this was, that was 2005 by this point. Actually, I know, yeah, it was 2005. So everything just opened up. And that was really the beginning of my career.
Did it feel different making that tune? Were you like,
yeah,
Fisher's studio right now listening, and you were showing us some tracks before. And I said to you, do you know when you're like, I think this is the one? Did you know when you were making that? Were you like, wow,
yeah, I did. I knew. I was like, it came together just like so quickly, just so naturally. And it just had such a good feeling. I was like, oh, I've got something here.
And then wasn't it getting played like in the Premier League or something?
Yeah. It was used for the Premier League football on Sky Sports for like a whole year. So it was a big record. It was actually really big here. There was a remix by an Australian artist called Dirty South. It was really big out here. So, And things were really going by that point. So
let's talk about this next chapter. So you finally get noticed, how you should be. You've been given a year, you get a manager. How long till you move out of Scotland?
2 years.
2 years.
So 2 years. There. Moved down to London. Moved down to the Big Smoke. So that was another big, you know, that was a big move. It was way easier to travel from there. You know, I was getting lots of gigs by this point. Flying out of Scotland, massive pain in the ass. Flying out of London, it was great.
Packed up and moved by yourself at like 24.
Well, yeah, 26. I was with Gita by this point.
Oh, you were Gita by this point. Yeah, how'd you meet Gita?
MySpace.
Yeah, that was she your top friend.
Yeah, she was. She was. So we were already living together.
So what, how'd you meet Gita in Scotland when you're 20?
MySpace.
Just where's Gita from?
She's born in Latvia, but she was living in America by this point. So,
and you met on MySpace. You were just an underground musician, and she's a musician herself, and connected. What? And then she came from America to Scotland.
Other way around. I went to America. So So I met her on the first time I went out to America.
So you did a tour over there.
And then I met her, caught eyes on her, and I'm like, oh shit.
Here we go.
That's it.
Wow.
I was going to show the wedding ring, but I'm not even wearing it. It's kind of bad.
You got a tan there.
You can see it's imprinted on your finger.
Yeah. She came to London with you?
She actually moved to Scotland first.
Oh, so she did move to Scotland.
Yeah, then we moved to London. We had a few years there, and then, but you know, things started. I'd started touring out in America, and there was a bit of a pull to go to America and take some of the opportunities there. I was really enjoying working in the studio there. Mm-hmm. I was meeting some good people. And Gita, you know, spent a lot of her life in America. She felt comfortable there. So we decided to make the move to LA. And that's where...
How old were you when you moved there?
29.
Okay, so that matches up perfectly with when you stopped drinking alcohol.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your relationship prior to giving up alcohol.
Yeah.
If you're willing to, because I think it'll
be... My relationship with Gita.
Well, no, your relationship with alcohol.
Oh, my relationship with alcohol. Yeah.
Well, just because I know that's where I was going to lead to, that you stopped drinking alcohol at 29. We'll talk about this last night because I had my year off and you had some funny comments about it last night. But if you moved to America at that time as well, dare I say, it's probably coming with a story or a reason why you gave up.
Yeah, it wasn't anything... crazy. I just felt like
touring the world DJ. Yeah, give me that explanation, because you're like, I'm starting to tour with America. I'm starting to tour the world DJ. Yeah. I've got every opportunity in the world to be a loose cannon.
Yeah, I just didn't like. I think, like, I'm British. I'm English, and there's definitely a glorification of being fucked up and, you know, getting into a mess and. I was very used to being like that, and but I guess I just started not really appreciating it in myself. I didn't like the way it left me feeling. I was getting, you know, starting to get a bit older by this point, and the hangovers were starting to take their bite. Anyway, I remember I went out on a bender with some friends in Miami during a Winter Music Conference, all the big parties that happen in March. It's like a big gathering of the industry. And I was absolutely hammered. And the next day I had to fly back to England. And I've never experienced a worse day in my life than that day. It was the worst hangover I've ever had in my life. It lasted about 4 days. And that flight was the most miserable trip. And I just said to myself, this is fucked. This is not gonna be good for me if I make this a habit. So I was like, yeah, do you know what? I'm done.
And just boom, haven't had a drink since. 12 years.
12 years.
Good on you, man. That's so cool for someone I've been out with you a couple of times and I've always known that you don't drink, because when I took my year off sober, like, you asked me the other day, like, you're still not drinking? I was like, no, sorry, man, I'm not on your team anymore. but to know that you used to be on the other team makes me, it doesn't change anything, but I'm like, okay, it wasn't like, and just the way that you describe it and just went, yep, there wasn't like this big moment or there wasn't this like,
no,
good on you. It was a realization that, hey, if I want my career to continue, it needs to.
No, I've always been driven. I haven't always been driven, but I am driven to I want to, if I'm going to do something, I want to do it well. Mm. And I do care about what I do. I care about people having a good time. I care about me being like in your a good place self, yeah. to give people a good time. I'm not like, that might not be in like my physical performance. It's just like, it's just through my choices and my musical choices. And I just think I make them better when I'm sober and more aware and feeling good about myself. And I feel a lot better about myself not drinking. So it was nice to get rid of it. I feel a lot better for it. I feel like I've got a lot more focus, clarity, and I'm able to just look after myself in general better because of it. So I don't miss it one bit, but I will say like, you know, I'm also quite comfortable in not fitting in or standing out, which I do think is quite a big part of, you know, it is like a social kind of separator from me and, you know, whoever I'm with. You know, I'm normally the only one not drinking and it definitely changes the way that the flow of the night, the longer the night goes on, kind of like you start to get fucking annoying.
Yeah, I'm out of it.
Yeah.
But it's hard because you DJ so late sometimes. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's nice seeing, yeah, the way that you guys take it so professionally. And we were talking about it last night. I love the way that you described that at the start of what you were just saying, that there's a responsibility. Like there's these people that are throwing these huge events, there's people who are paying all this money to come and watch you. And then every now and then you do see a DJ or a musician who's just like off chops and you're like, there's a responsibility that comes with that. Yeah. So does he have that professionalism? So nice to hear.
Yeah. I mean, there's some people can conduct themselves in a really good way in that state. Mm. But most people think they can conduct themselves well in that state. That's the problem. But they think that because they're pissed.
Well, that was like when I took my year off. What I really started to notice was I'd go out sober and I'd see myself in other people. I'd be like, fuck, that's me. I think that I'm not that bad, but like that. And I'm like, oh, that's like, you'd get it all the time. The people who like you'd see sober and then drunk and like the change.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, that's what most of us do. It's like trying to bring it back to that level. So
difficult. It's fine. So, you know, different people.
Well, there's like no judgment, but that, like when I was doing it, it was absolutely no judgment, but just like, observation of like, oh, that's when I think I'm not being a bit,
the truth is like, I've said this so many times, but like, listen, the worst substance that anyone takes in these, you know, clubs, pubs, whatever, is alcohol. It's the worst one. People act like a fuckwit. It's so annoying. And it's almost like, but it's the substance that kind of feel like it makes people get involved in other people's business, like get you, like, you know, when a drunk person's all up in other people's faces, it's like, you know, whereas like when people are doing like recreational drugs and stuff like that, most of the time they're having their own experience. They might look a bit dumb sometimes, but like, you know, they're kind of they're having like their own internal experience, and that, you know, don't really fuck with other people's.
So it's kind of like, alcohol is the opposite.
Yeah, alcohol, it's just everyone turns into a fucking nose. You know?
Some are okay, but most.
Not that many.
Not many.
Not that many.
You can see plenty of them every time you go around. Let's talk about your 30s now. So you moved to LA, career's starting to go on the up and up. Is that when, did you start getting managed by Brett back then?
Yeah. So that was about
when you got to LA?
About 10 years ago. So okay. Yeah, I've been there a couple of years.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, talk to me about that next chapter of like, there's a lot of people who make a big track or have a few tracks that are doing well and then disappear. You've had one of the careers.
I had a bit of a strange one where I really lost myself quite around that period where I moved to America. So I lost a lot of confidence in my music, in what I was making, where I was going, where the scene was at, where I fit. And I started making some really, really crap decisions. I made lots of decisions made kind of based on what other people were telling me they thought I should be doing, rather than following what I felt was the right thing to do. And it really kind of like led to, I also made some decisions based on money, which up to that point I'd not done. and I don't do anymore either. But in that period, I was making decisions based on just for the wrong reasons. And anyway, I lost myself, and I lost my I didn't love what I was doing. I got caught up in very, very bad record deal, and I just, things really got out of hand. I just started working with Brett for management, and soon after that, I kind of just had this, I had this big moment of kind of soul searching and clarity, essentially, where I was just like, I'm doing the wrong things, and I'm doing the wrong things for the wrong reasons, and I need to course correct.
What brought about that reflection, and what were some of the things that you did to soul search?
I felt fucking shit. I was playing, drinking, or anything too. So I had clarity. So I was doing shows, and I just remember just getting getting taken back to the hotel or whatever after the show, and just like the doors shut, and I'm just like, what am I doing? It was kind of
and that's still already playing like pretty big gigs and stuff.
It was just not
no fulfillment.
I was just like, what?
At your purpose.
Wow. And this is sort of I've completely veered off into this sort of I was just making decisions that I was not happy with. So luckily, I'd recently started working with Brett, and I think there was an understanding or an acknowledgement from Brett as well that, you know, I was not happy, and I don't think this was something that was going to be serving me long term. So what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do to change this? How do we fix this? So really, I actually ended up going back to Scotland for a week. I had all these conversations with my parents, and I think they actually showed me some old articles of like old interviews that I'd done, where I was actually talking about what kind of inspired me, what fueled me. And I was given like these reminders, like almost like of who I am and where you come from. Yeah. And anyway, I just started thinking about really the music that I really wanted to make, and started making it essentially. Deciding to only do the things that I wanted to do. And so this is when the most difficult part of my career began, where I had a career where I had had some success. I'd had some big records. However, I felt like I was building a reputation that I didn't feel comfortable being remembered by. So I wanted to fix that. So I basically went on a rampage, and I made very, very, very difficult decisions with regards to shows. I turned down so many shows because it was the wrong thing. I had to say no to like 90% of what I was asked to do, which is quite difficult when
you're getting off a big money to play.
You've also got to live. You've got to pay your bills. So, made some difficult decisions, and over time, tried to essentially rebuild my reputation.
Yeah, I was gonna say, so you're making tracks and putting stuff out and playing music that wasn't really what you loved.
Yeah.
Recognizing you're doing well with it, but you're like, nah, I need to steer this ship in a different direction and come back to what I love.
Yeah. So I worked hard on it. It was difficult. And by that point, you know, within the industry, there was preconceptions of who I was. And, you know, it would have been far easier to give up on the career and start a new alias, start a new name. That would have been by far the most easy thing to do. Mm-hmm. But because my Chris Lake's my real name, mm-hmm. I was loathed to just give up on something that represented me, because it was me. So I've worked hard at essentially rewriting the story about my reputation.
Wow.
I guess. And so over time it all started coming together. I kind of essentially started rewriting the story, and each step I took, like each song kind of just took me a step further and further into be it like doing just more accurately what I love. And then things really started to kick off. So
what was the first big song once you changed back this direction that I'm sure people listening will know about?
I think the most pivotal one was Operator. That song really, really, really caught on in the scene, and it just got people talking. Just like, it just ended up being a really, really, really hot mm-hmm. record. Everyone was playing it. All the cool guys were playing it, and girls. And it just changed everything for me.
How did it feel for you? Did it feel good? You're like, yes, the songs that I'm actually passionate about are doing well. Did that change your perception on yourself?
Yeah, I started to get the rewards I was looking for. Just starting to do the shows that I wanted to do, and having the recognition for the songs in the right places. Mm-hmm. So it felt good. And it's just not really stopped. I've kind of had this approach now for 10 years. I only do things I love. I don't make decisions for money, which is like really how I started. I'm true to myself. I do things to make me happy. I do things that, you know, I'm interested in. And things have kind of flourished because of it.
Right, it's a great story for people to see that it's all well and good to become successful, but if it's for something that doesn't actually sit true to you, then it's not horrible. Fulfilling. That's the thing. It's like, you're perfect. And I had no idea. I'm sure so many people listening probably had no idea about that. Now you've found this space where it seems like you're super healthy, you're happy, you're on this path where you're making music that's making obviously a huge impact. I want to talk about two shows in particular to finish
mm-hmm.
that I can probably talk to you a bit differently about than most people, obviously, with Fisher being my brother-in-law. Tell me about Coachella.
I'm sorry, mate.
We'll get him on the podcast one day. Hopefully this has inspired him. And hopefully this might be the first episode he listens to of the podcast as well.
Fuck, he will have switched off ages ago.
But tell me about Coachella this year. Was that one of the special ones for you?
Oh, 100%, you know.
Yeah, give me your top three, but hopefully in them is Coachella and Hollywood this year.
No, do you know what? Honestly, there's been...
So many.
Yeah, but some of the best ones have been with Fish.
Coachella, closing Coachella.
You've got to realize as well. Time. So, you know, just to give you some perspective.
Give me a relationship with Paul. When did you meet Paul? And like,
well, you know, I met him.
Can't say probably at the start because you're managed by Brett together.
Yeah, obviously we had a lot of awareness of each other, but we didn't meet for a while. I met Paul and Seds, and got on great with them. They're just fucking great guys. And there's just a lot of synergy there. Mm. He's such a fun energy to be around.
Mm-hmm.
And inspiring as well. He's very inspiring. It's like his energy and his passion is very infectious.
Mm.
I don't think people maybe realize that this actually sounds really sappy, but it's true. He kind of lights up a room, not just being a DJ. You kind of like, you know, and you feel his presence when he walks in, you know, just coming in for a coffee or whatever. Mm. He just has this sort of presence he carries with him. And then, but when he's turning it on and he's performing, it's significant.
It's difficult
to ignore. He's got a very commanding presence, and it's like, you know, and now you match it with the music. It's pretty damn powerful.
It's crazy. That's one of the things that I love from just quickly like watching him. There's not many DJs in the world that, for one, even let people stand behind them. But what he does is has all of his crew behind him, and not only plays to the crowd, but will turn around and one by one like froth all of his friends behind him up. Yeah. And I'm like, how he manages to do that and give everyone the, like, you know.
I know, it's intense.
It's phenomenal.
So, you know, yeah, so talking about like the shows that made a mark on me. Yeah. Well, but... There's been quite a synergy with both of our careers rising up. We've done, you know, a lot of shows together now, and we're mates. You know, we're kind of like we share a love of the music, that's for sure. And you know, I think we inspire each other. So, we just got really lucky with the way that, like, the scene was kind of growing. We were kind of at the center of it, and we were asked at EDC, I think it was 2017, we were asked to close the main stage together. By this point, Fish had never played a main stage in his life. And I was like, we were having a play after Afrojack. And I'm like, oh, that's going to be hell. Afrojack plays so fucking heavy. And they're like, oh, we're just going to get eaten alive. We'll come on. And everyone's going to be like, you know, come on, I'm going home. And so we actually said no. We said no to the show for a few weeks. And Pasquale Rotella, the owner of EDC, was like, I really, really want you to close this. You're my two favorite artists right now. This is the show I want the festival to close, because I want to hear it. Mm-hmm. Please do it. And I'm like, yeah, but it's after Afrojack. Come on, this is not easy. And anyway, we ended up saying yes to it. And I remember saying to Paul, I'm like, mate, don't be disheartened if we finish the first record and half the crowd's fucked off. Which I genuinely thought was going to happen, but it didn't happen.
It made a
big impression, because it was like that time, it was like this is unheard of, having house acts playing on the main stage, holding a crowd, people talking about it, people, you know, loving it. So it was a big thing. And so this idea, just off the back of that show, the idea of us two playing together was very in demand. And so what ended up happening was this leads to the sister and that. We knew that we had something with this. We loved doing it. We loved playing together. It was a lot of fun. You know, we're great mates. But all of our social circles, we're all friends as well. Mm. So it was like, okay, well, why don't we just do this sporadically and just use it as an opportunity to get everyone together. So really the attitude behind the shows that we do is that we're getting the friends together.
That's
why we have everyone up on stage. That's why we have the party with everyone. That's why, you know, it's like a party that we have with our friends, and we allow everyone else to watch us have the party.
But it's so cool as well, and you might be able to answer this. I can't recall there's many other DJs that do both of their names back to back. Like, quite often you end up with like Jack U or Major Lazer and create a combo thing, whereas you guys never did that, which is sick. I love that.
No, because it's like, it's literally just what it is. It's just the two of us playing records instead of us doing it individually. And it's fun. It's like, it's nothing. We're not. We just turn up and play our absolute. We just wallop people around the heads with our tunes. It's basically what we try to do, and try and have the best time. And it's just developed into this thing. So, you know, leading up to, after the first few shows, we were like, we have something here. Yeah. We talked about where could this go, and Coachella was the one that we were like, if we're going to do a festival again, that's going to be the one we'll do. We want to close down the outdoor stage at Coachella. So that was our goal. We thought we were going to be doing it sooner, but COVID obviously changed things. And so our opportunity didn't come around until this year. And fuck, it was ridiculous. It was so good. It was like an unbelievably memorable show. We had everyone there. You know, your sister was there, and Gita was, my wife was there, and all of our friends. And yeah, it was special. It was an unbelievably memorable show. And then that led on to the Hollywood show we did together.
How's the conversation when you get off stage and you get a moment and it's just you and Paul? There's not everyone around you. What's that? Is it just you guys going like, what the fuck?
Yeah, there was a bit of disbelief. Like, I sound like such a pessimist, but like, I said to him, I'm like, oh, fuck. I don't know if this is going to be any good. We've worked so hard on this, but fuck, I hope people turn up.
And he's the biggest show of all time at Coachella.
Yeah, I know. I was just like, fuck, I hope people turn up. I hope it's going to be a good crowd. And even just like 10, 15 minutes before, I'm kind of like, you know, crossing my fingers. And we walk out and it's like the biggest crowd they've had at that stage.
Ever.
And ever. And it was, it was so intense. So, you know, played the intro. There's a video up on my Instagram of when we do the intro and we walk out and you can see how nervous we are. Well, definitely see how nervous I am. And then the first drop happens and we're like, okay,
game on.
Yeah,
how does it feel? Do you get nervous other than
that one I was nervous. I was very, very nervous.
But you guys have planned and like know exactly what song's going into what song, or do you kind of freestyle a little bit when it's a tour?
That one we planned that out because the reason being it was by far the shortest set that we'd done.
Okay.
Normally we like up until then minimum three.
Wow.
So we worked out what we were going to do on that one because it was like we were actually worried that it was just like it wasn't going to feel the same because we were rushing it.
It's hard. How do you choose? Like both of you have such mega songs, and then you got to throw some other stuff in there too.
We had fun putting it all together and performing it but that one was different. You know, every other time we fully wing it. Like when we did the I was just thinking like when we did Three Nights at the Shrine in LA, that was 2018, I think. And by far the biggest shows we'd both done together, but all sold out like that. And
crazy.
I just remember just thinking how little effort we put into that. And I think it was 5 minutes. It was less than 5 minutes before. And I'm like,
what are we gonna start?
What are we gonna start with? What do you reckon? Yeah, let's do that one. You know, kind of, we just decided there and then.
Oh my God, that's outrageous.
We've got a lot of belief in what we'll do.
We'll play off the energy. Because that's the thing, as a DJ, is it quite often playing off the energy of the crowd? Having a pretty good idea of the songs that you want to play, but then kind of building it up.
Yeah, interesting.
It's
fun. So we had a lot of fun with that. And there's some pretty memorable shows.
For the last question, let's talk about real quickly Hollywood. That was something that was out of this world, that intro with Hemsworth and all of that. Mm-hmm. Talk me about that, shutting down Hollywood Boulevard for the first time ever.
Yeah, that was that took 4 years of planning, and that was such a stressful show because there was so much stuff to organize with, so many people to convince to allow us to do that show. And then once we got the city approval, we then kind of like needed individual businesses approval. We got fucked over so badly by some of these businesses, you know.
In the street who had to get closed down for a day or two.
It cost us a fortune. But by this point we were like,
so committed.
There's no way we're not doing this now. There's no way. And it was unbelievable. It was probably 100 times better than I thought it was gonna be.
Wow.
So then like the week of the show, Fish is like, We've got to do an intro. We have to do an intro. And we're talking about, what we can do. What's the right thing to do for a show in Hollywood? So I was like, I can't remember who suggested it, but I was like, maybe we just need to do something very on the nose Hollywood. You know, we could like try and make something quite cinematic.
Mm.
And then we talked about, I think Fish suggested about getting like a speech from, you know, someone. Okay, what's the most Hollywood thing we can do? And then I says, well, what do you
Your
ask?
Best mate.
Well, Thor. Yeah, exactly. What do you ask Hemsworth? I mean, that's just about as on the nose. He's like, fuck it, I'll ask him. So he spoke to Chris and he's like, yeah, all right. Yeah, hurry up because if you give me an idea of what you want, I'm going camping in 24 hours. I'll record it. If you can get me a script. So Fish wrote that script
The rest is history.
Yeah. Got the voice notes sent over and then, we both, I think Fish put together the, the beat for the intro. I added some strings onto it.
That was just wild.
Like, I just remember like us playing this to each other. I was like, holy shit, this is unbelievable. I think this is like the best fucking thing ever. And then this is the worst bit. The morning of the show, I'm just like, yes, we've got it. Pretty much the only thing that we knew we were going to play was the intro. That was the only thing we planned. And then I played it to Gita, my wife, and she goes, do you really think this is a good idea? And I'm like, no, fuck. So like I'm starting to like second guess, is this actually a good idea to play? And but then by this point, it was like, okay, if we don't play this, and we literally have nothing. We're just playing a song and this is going to be whack. So we played it.
Yeah, you did it, went off. It was so good.
That clip's unbelievable. I've never watched a clip as much as I've watched that.
Oh, it is just the best thing ever. Yeah. It's so, so good. But man, this has been an epic chat. I appreciate the honesty and sharing a bunch about your story. I've learned so much. I'm sure a lot of people listening would have learned some really insightful lessons, whether it be about your upbringing and having to work hard to go and get your first equipment, to going, you know what, I'm going to give myself one more year, got after it, to taking the time off or quitting alcohol, to redirecting your career. There's so many parts, man, that I really appreciate.
I was nearly an architect. Fuck, I probably would have been shit.
Just architect, amazing music. Yeah. The last question I do finish all my podcasts with, I'm excited to hear what you answer this. What does being a good human mean to Chris Lake? Take your time.
I think definitely it's got to be being a good service to other people, right? Having providing something for others, right? It's sort of it's natural to look after yourself. It's very immediate, very kind of like primal to kind of like look after yourself. But I think it's very good to look after others as well. You know, doing something for others, and you know, spreading happiness, positivity, and you know, nurturing, whatever.
Mate, well, you're doing just that. Thank you so much for having a chat. Thanks for all the music you do too. I've actually got to show you a video. I use one of your songs on every one of my keynotes when I show my ambassadors. Oh, yeah? It's one of your songs. I'll show it to you in a sec. There you go. I'll get you payback for you ripping off some music back in
the day. I love it.
But anyway, man, thank you so much for jumping on Good Humans.
Yeah, bro.
You're the man.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.